This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Unions are often criticized as obstacles to productivity. My guests argue that stronger labor unions are needed to help us compete in the global market. My guests are father and son, and they've come to this conclusion from two different perspectives. Irving Bluestone, the father, is the former vice president of the United Auto Workers and the director of its GM department. Barry Bluestone, the son, is a professor of political economy at the University of Massachusetts and the co-author of the book The Deindustrialization of America. The Bluestones collaborated on a new book called Negotiating the Future, a labor perspective on American business. They recommend that labor take on more responsibility for increasing productivity and management take on more responsibility for job security. It's usually the other way around.
Well, I think if you go back and you take a look at the post-war period from, let's say, 1947 through the early 70s, we had what we call the traditional workplace contract. You know, labor looked out for wages. They looked out to make sure their members had the fringe benefits, the economic employment security. Management worried about everything else. And that may have worked, and in fact, it did work wonders in a world in which you had no international competition that we had to worry about. Today, of course, at least since the 1970s, we have to worry about international competition. And if labor doesn't worry about that just as much as management, the ultimate end of that will be the lack of jobs. You'll lose jobs. You'll see plants close down. You'll see people lose their standard of living. And we've seen that happen in industry after industry. So it's almost natural in a modern global economy for labor to be as concerned about the competitiveness of the American economy as management. But our old-style labor management relations simply does not let labor play a role in precisely those kinds of decisions that could lead to greater productivity. That's what we're talking about in the book.
Do you think that unions sometimes almost stood in the way of productivity because it worked against their interests? For instance, if the same number of workers could produce more in the same amount of time, well, then the company could have laid off some of those workers and still get done what they needed. Increasing productivity could mean fewer jobs.
There were many examples of that, obviously, but there were also excellent examples in which it was the union which pressured for improved productivity. By the way, in the mines, John L. Lewis was among the first labor leaders to insist on the introduction of new technology in the mines in order to make them more efficient and more productive. I know that in my own union, our famous president, Walter Reuther, invariably argued for increasing productivity growth rates on the basis that out of that you produce more wealth and out of that you have the opportunity for a more equitable distribution of that wealth. So, yes, there are those instances in which there was resistance to the introduction of technology, but there were many, many instances as expressed by leaders and as, in fact, were practiced to work toward the enhancement of productivity growth rates.
I'd also suggest, Terry, that today there's more pressure than ever for labor to help improve productivity, because if you don't get that productivity improvement, you don't remain competitive, and the result is you lose job security rather than gain job security. So that where productivity at one point might have been a four-letter word, despite all the syllables in the word, today productivity is something that's just as important to labor as it is for management for job security.
I have a favorite little anecdote about this in terms of quality. Back in 1973, and I came upon my papers on this recently when I was going through my stuff down in the basement of my home, I had issued a bulletin notice as director of the General Motors Department of the union to all General Motors local unions. And this bulletin notice was to go up and did go up on union bulletin boards inside the plant. And what did it say? It said, quality is our concern too. And it urged the employees, given the tools and given enough time to do the job, to make certain that what they produced was a quality product. Why? Very simply. Quality sells, therefore you have better employment security. Poor quality won't sell, you're out of a job. Believe it or not, within a few weeks after these notices went up, I received a call from an executive of the corporation demanding that they be taken down, arguing that quality was management's business, not the union's business. Now, that was 1973. Today, union and management all over this country in many, many industries are joining together to do precisely that, namely, improve quality so that it becomes more competitive. And we have quality networks rampant around various industries, and the proof of the pudding is in the eating. In the auto industry today, the American-made cars, using the quality network approach, are now very close to, if not even surpassing, the imports in quality.
If you're just joining us, my guests are the co-authors of the new book, Negotiating the Future, A Labor Perspective on American Business. My guests are father and son. Irving Bluestone is the father. He's a retired vice president of the United Auto Workers and the former director of the United Auto Workers GM department. And Barry Bluestone is a political economist at the University of Massachusetts and has written extensively about deindustrialization, the state of the economy, and American labor. You're arguing for bringing more democracy into the workplace, for giving more decision-making power to workers. What's in it for management?
Well, I think what we've argued in the book is for taking many of the things that historically have been management's prerogatives, the prerogative over design, over engineering, over investment, over subcontracting, even over pricing, marketing, advertising, and saying labor has a role and a constructive role in this. Now, management's immediate reaction would be, hold on a second. Historically, that's been our position. We want to hold on to that position. That's why we go to the Harvard Business School or wherever to learn these skills. Our response to that is that labor, in fact, has a lot to offer, particularly if you can develop joint responsibility for setting productivity targets, as we ask for in what we call the Enterprise Compact, joint responsibility for setting high-quality standards and meeting those. Because it's out of that productivity, it's out of that quality, it's out of the commitment of labor and management to meet very high productivity and quality and innovation standards that management gets the profits that the stockholders want. After all, we recognize fully that in the system we live in, managers exist in order to be able to have a profitable operation so that the stockholders are happy. Our argument is that if labor can play a role in making stockholders happy and at the same time enhance their job security and down the road improve their standard of living, this is the kind of win-win situation that both management and labor can both adhere to.
You know, I bet a lot of our listeners are thinking, okay, agreed that there should be better relations between management and labor, but unions are so used to a more adversarial relationship that they're the wrong mechanism to use to change relations between labor and management. And the reason why you're defending that unions are important in this new kind of relationship is because you're union guys. You know, Irving Bluestone, you spent your life working for the UIW, and Barry Bluestone, well, you believe in unions.
I'm genetically that way, I guess.
Well, I'd put it this way. Even at the point 25 years ago when I became an advocate of the employee involvement process and decision-making, there weren't very many buying into it in the labor movement and practically none among the management business groups. Take a look at it today. There are literally hundreds of situations involving companies and unions in which this joint action process is taking place, and it's in many different industries. The auto industry out of which I come is one of them, but rubber, electrical, even the public sector, the telecommunications industry. I could go on and on and on, listing plant after company, in which union and management are indeed working together.
Do you think that the old unions are able to change, or do you think we need some kind of new unions or new mechanism to really create changing relations between management and labor?
Change is always difficult, and it's very difficult if you've been in a situation in which labor and management have been at loggerheads, where management has been trying to find a way to become lean and mean, downsize. We just saw where General Motors announced 8 more plants that it's closing down. It's pretty hard to get workers revved up about improving productivity and quality when at the same time they face such job insecurity. But the fact is, and I've been critical of my own union, I'm a member of a teachers union, I'm also a member of the auto workers union as a writer, which has been affiliated with the UAW, rather a strange alliance perhaps, that we need to have some serious change in the attitude of labor leaders at the national level, at the local level, in the same way we need to have some serious changes in the way management thinks about its job. Our hope is that the book we've written will get both management and labor to start thinking in different ways about how they might be able to begin to develop the kind of joint action enterprise compacts that we talk about. We fully recognize that the kinds of things we've talked about in this book may be called visionary, may be called utopian. They have been. But our feeling is that maybe it's time for a few new visions and a few new utopian possibilities, and that will get us to move off dead center, to move in the direction of some real progress. And if our book does that, I will have considered this one of the most successful things I've ever done.
Barry, let me ask you to explain what an enterprise compact is.
Well, we came up with the concept of the enterprise compact in this book, and we contrast it with what has been the traditional workplace contract. If you think back about the post-war era, the workplace contract, which has been negotiated between labor and management, one, it's done about the workplace. It's where the worker works, in the office or the factory, what have you. And it's a contract, which means it's an agreement between two parties who have fundamental differences and are trying to find some way to come to grips with those differences. The enterprise compact that we talk about, first of all, has to do with the enterprise. It's the whole establishment, right up to the senior management. And second of all, it's a compact. We looked at the Mayflower Compact of 1620 that the Pilgrims wrote. Here were a group of people in what they saw as a fairly hostile land facing common problems and trying to find a way to work on them together. So what we suggest in the enterprise compact is that labor and management come together. They have some common problems they have to work with: productivity, quality, innovation, working together to be competitive in a global economy. And it's time that labor and management began to see that there's more in common than in conflict. And this is what the enterprise compact is all about.
I might say also that this is not pie in the sky when we look at what is actually happening out there. As I noted, there are literally hundreds of situations that we can point to, and we use some concrete examples in the book to establish that indeed this can work. The most notable example that we have found in terms of the enterprise compact is the Saturn Corporation in Spring Hill, Tennessee, a subsidiary of General Motors Corporation, in which the union and the management not only at the workplace level worked together to solve problems, but by consensus arrangement under their agreement, matters such as Barry mentioned relative to strategic and policy making are handled together. They even decide who their dealers will be. They decide what kind of advertising they'll do. They decide on the price of the automobile. You can name the basic strategic decisions that normally management makes. And here at Saturn, they're being made jointly and successfully. And when I say successfully, I mean it in this fashion. The quality of that automobile is rated among the highest of any automobiles on sale in the U.S. today. The demand for the automobile is such that production has not been able to keep up with it, and so they're in the process now of adding a third shift in order to meet that demand. Very little of that is happening in industry today, but we see it in this situation as a concrete example of what the vision can bring about, and we are hopeful that it will spread.
General
Terry,
the
Enterprise Compact itself has an interesting history. I actually was the one who first started using that term some years ago. There's a General Motors plant out in Van Nuys, California, and it was going through a tough time, and it looked like the corporation might close it down. And a very progressive plant manager, a guy named Ernie Schaefer, and a very fine union representative there, decided together to try and change the entire culture of the plant. And what they did, 4,000 people working there, was close down the plant for 2 weeks, and they took over an abandoned junior high school, and they put everybody in the plant, from the plant manager right through to the janitor on the floor, through 2 weeks of training in teamwork. And they invited me to come in, and I was in a very strange position because we did this outdoors. We did it in the football stadium. I felt something like a rock star with these big speakers, addressing 2,000 people at a time. Somehow in the middle of the speech, I decided to do something different, was to say, what could the world look like if we all collectively made the kinds of decisions that management makes today? And I ticked off, how about we both work together to hit productivity targets, quality, innovation? What would happen if we, in fact, were to be able to strike if the quality, go on strike if the quality didn't meet our standards. And all of a sudden, there was a standing ovation. 2,000 people stood up, more or less, and said, that's what we want to do. And I've tried that out over and over again with audiences of management, with labor. And after a while, it began to stick. And so we decided that was really going to be the target of the book, to talk about not what exists so much today, even with the improvements we've made, but let's talk about tomorrow. Let's look at the 21st century and see if, in fact, we can't use this last decade of the 1990s to begin to make the moves we need to do in labor management relations to be fully competitive by the next century.
My guests are Barry and Irving Bluestone, co-authors of the new book Negotiating the Future. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Barry Bluestone, a professor of political economy, and his father Irving Bluestone, retired vice president of the United Auto Workers. They've collaborated on a new book about labor management relations. You know, unions are blamed a lot for the problems that the United States has been having with competitiveness, particularly in the auto industry. Now, in the auto industry, there's been tremendous layoffs. The auto industry has had a great deal of difficulty being competitive, and part of that has been blamed on the labor unions for high wages, and I don't know if productivity has been an issue there, too. But can I ask you if you think that any of the blame is justly put on the auto union?
I'd like to put it this way. If you take a look at the labor costs in terms of wages and benefits in our chief competitors in the automobile industry abroad, Germany, Japan, Sweden, etc., you will find that in those countries, except for Japan, which is just about equal now with the U.S., but in the European countries, those costs are higher than they are in the U.S., and yet they are competitive. The question, then, is not so much, gee, are wages too high, as much as how do we compete in a global challenge by putting out a sound quality product at a price which people will be willing to pay. Right now, for instance, in the United States, American-made cars are selling at a price lower generally, model for model, than the Japanese cars. Our quality is beginning to match the Japanese. The problem is when people departed from purchasing the U.S. cars, it makes it very difficult to win them back, and this is the problem that the industry holds. The other one is this. When we talk about an enterprise compact and joint responsibility for decision-making at that top level, why is General Motors in trouble? Take a look at what they did. In the 1970s, they began building plants all over the country, but particularly in the South. Yes, they wanted to keep them non-union. They're not. They are within the union. But they expanded enormously their productive capacity, and they continued that into the 1980s. Why? Because it was their judgment, based upon the best figures that they had available to them, that the market in the U.S. was going to continue to grow and grow at a rapid pace. Not only that, but the GM anticipated that it would increase its market share from a little over 40% to around 50%. What happened? The market did not grow the way they anticipated, and instead of having a larger section of the market in GM's hands, it has reduced from a little over 40% to a little over 30%. Someone made a mistake. So a lot of plants are being shut down, not because of the union demands, not because of labor cost, but because of basic errors that were made, which now mean that they have too much productive capacity.
Barry Bluestone, what sticks with you the most about growing up in a labor family?
Well, I think I was one of the most fortunate people in my generation because I grew up in a family that was filled with a great deal of love, but it was a family that was tremendously extended. I grew up in the city of Detroit, went to a wonderful school, Mumford High School, just got back from my 30th high school reunion. It was a school that was integrated in an integrated part of the city. I grew up with friends from all kinds of backgrounds, and I revisited that just a couple weeks ago. I think it was very special growing up in a family that was part of a movement that was really committed to building a better country, not just for the well-to-do, but for everyone. And I think it influenced the rest of my life.
As a matter of fact, I might add to that. At the ripe age of 14, Barry was already making speeches about civil rights and civil liberties. And he also led some pickets, as I recall, to see to it that African Americans would have the right to swim in a pool which was privately owned. He succeeded, so that in his early years, he began to look at the broad social issues, and he's continued to do that the rest of his life. I think that's just great.
Barry, was it hard growing up with a father who was such a good negotiator? Did you ever win an argument?
Very rarely. I remember days in which we negotiated. We had a strike one day. We went away for a week to a cottage on a lake, and the young kids were always responsible for cleaning the fish. And I think we used to get a nickel a fish, and we finally went on strike for a dime. And after all-night negotiations, we won 7.5 cents.
Irving Bluestone, are you very nostalgic for, quote, you know, the kind of glory days of the union movement, or are you spending more time looking ahead to a future?
I'm one of those optimists. I think that there's going to be a turnaround. I think the labor movement is going to begin organizing more effectively than it has in the past, and that it will restore the kind of elevated opinion that people did have in earlier years of what the union movement is and is all about, and that is as a social movement, as a part of the democratic system and advancing the democratic values we believe in.
I thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you.
Barry and Irving Bluestone are co-authors of the new book Negotiating the Future, A Labor Perspective on American Business. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.